Hello, and welcome to the show. My name is Donovan Morgan Grant, and I am joined by Mr. Harrison Chute.
Hello.
And this is Questions We Don't Have Answers. The two of us have been podcasting for some years now. Harry's been analyzing sci-fi on a social-political scale, and I've done shows on superhero comic books and superhero comic book media. So we've been in the podcasting game for a while, but thought we'd like to up our ante and try to talk about things that really matter. Things that people try to talk about but tend not to. Sociology, society, culture, race.
We need food.
So the purposes of this podcast is to have as honest and uncompromising a discussion as humanly possible. So hopefully this podcast will
explode the world.
Broaden your mindset and give way to critical thinking, because critical thinking is where it all begins. So sit back, enjoy, and give us your thoughts once you hear our takes on the subject matters of today. Welcome back to Questions We Don't Have Answers for the year of 2018. Let's do this. My name is Donovan, and I am joined by Mr. Harry Chute.
Fortunately, yes.
Yes, I've not replaced him with all my other friends.
It came close. It was a stern talking to after the last episode.
Every episode I thought about firing Harry. You know, just to shake things up. So we're going to start the year off, hopefully right, with the right foot forward, or we're going to break our hero and fall on our faces. We'll see. But first, before we get into the topic, which you already know of because you've downloaded this episode, we have a single email that we'd like to read out. It is by a returning email by our friend Mariama, no last name given, because I don't want to reveal her secret identity. And I will read it out, because as always, she writes in a very, very thought-provoking email. She writes, "Dear Harrison and Donovan, I'm quite puzzled at a piece of listener feedback you received and read aloud in your latest episode, in which both the listener and the two of you explained away the Harrison Ford assault kiss, trademark pending, an empire as a part of the will-they-won't-they trope. The Force kiss, in my opinion, is its own trope. There have been examples of this since time immemorial. It was really popular in the early 20th century, with books like The Sheik, made later into a film with 1920s heartthrob Rudolph Valentino, where the heroine, by extension the reader, could indulge in their wildest sexual fantasies without the shame of, quote, wanting it too much, quote. Because even in books and films today, women who are sexually promiscuous, who own their sexuality, are punished by the text. I think this is also in part responsible for society's continuing obsession with the Jack the Ripper murders. The victims were prostitutes, so it's okay for us to still revel in the gruesome details of their deaths. A more modern example of this being all the police procedurals in which sexy women are titillatingly murdered for our pleasure. If a woman pursues a man, or doesn't put up enough of a fight, she gets an unsympathetic death at the end of the novel. But if she's forced, then we the audience can watch that steamy kiss, read the sex scenes, and still root for the main female protagonist. It's a way of circumventing the natural shame associated with female desire, which comes about due to a lifetime of slut-shaming. In short, Princess Leia could kiss her love interest, wear a gold medal bikini, and still be admired and respected as a good girl, because she was forced. The forced kiss trope, like most things in life, is also a lot more nuanced than the explanation I just gave. Some women just like fantasizing about domineering men, and reading books and watching films and television is a healthy outlet for those fantasies. It's also in part a male power fantasy. Being so good at kissing that the damsel just melts in your arms and submits to you is a little hot, don't you think? The will they won't
No.
They... I was waiting for the bomb to hit. The will they won't they trope is something is something else altogether. When done the will they won't they trope is something else altogether. When done well and interestingly, it's a great way of building tension or justifying to your audience why these two characters deserve one another. The purpose of the long drawn out romance is to develop and improve both characters as individuals before testing them out as a couple. Although you both talked about The Office, I've never watched the US Office, but in the UK version, which is only 14 episodes long, the Jim and Pam characters get together at the very end in a special Christmas episode. Spoilers! Nah, I don't care. I don't care. I actually think I knew that. As an audience member, I never had time to consider the complications you both brought up. I was too busy punching the air and reveling in the only lighthearted thing to happen in all 8 hours of watching the show. The point I'm trying to make is that, like all tropes, that will they, won't they, is only as good as the show it's used in. Happy New Year, Merry. P.S. I really like the idea of telling the listeners of the topic beforehand and then responding to / building on what they write in. I'm not on any social media, so if you decide to go with this plan, could you regularly update your website, please? Cheers. I think that, like, we've kind of slacked off lately in terms of announcing what the next episode is going to be, because like half the time we kind of not really thought about it, because we used to really, really struggle. I don't know if this is a lot of inside baseball, but, you know, there are hours collectively assembled of us figuring out what the next episode is going to be before we come back and says, so for our next episode, and that's not the reason why we stopped doing that, but like, we kind of gotten a little lazy with that. But generally we like to have an idea of what we'll do. Like, for this episode, we'll figure out what we're going to do and kind of announce it. And announce, you know, and we always like to announce if people have any thoughts on the topic before we have the episode come out, send it to us, and we kind of respond to it. So we'll try to just be a lot more diligent with that. But, Harry, what did you think about what she had to say about, kind of like force and romance, her take on that, and her take on sort of like the history of how it's perceived by female audiences, and like, basically, you know, her overall thoughts. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I mean, I love this email because it connects tropes the way that we match the forced kiss trope to as a kind of reason for why, power dynamics are such in such a way in media and always slanted in a certain favor. Like, it's just to kind of hear that, you know, kind of establish that, like, it makes sense that forcing a kiss on someone or romantic advancement on the woman allows them to stay pure. Like, that's incredibly crucial. And to see these things all come together, bad stereotypes clicking together as kind of an overall narrative stemming from sexism, kind of helps the case that, you know, sexism exists and that it can manifest dangerously in media. And second of all, it's funny because I do remember you criticizing the movie Limitless, among others, for this exact trope. And it's funny that I remember that we didn't quite we didn't quite make the distinction between the scene in Empire with the will they won't they, because they were kind of just part of the same general discussion. But yeah, I mean, I know that you have thoughts on that matter.
Well, I feel that, like, kind of like what she's talking about, you know, with like this idea of, you know, why women might like the sort of, you know, kind of the Harrison Ford assault kiss in one way or another. I mean, it's perfectly sound to me. How she frames it as ways in which women can be accepted for their sexuality, you know, like if they're too aggressive. Like, she made me think. I've never actually seen a story where the woman pursues a man and the happy ending is that she gets him, and, like, you know, in the same way that a man might, you know, like you insert your Bill Murray comedy here, where he basically does everything, you know, that's basically against the law, and, you know, a happy ending is enjoyed by all. Like, I've not seen a woman do that and have it work out, but I feel as though that, like, because in my opinion. And we talked about this whole exploration of romantic tropes is going to be either our next episode or the episode after that, because it's really fascinating on a number of kind of like talking branches. And I think that, like, yeah, would the question arise that should a woman, you know, kind of be, like, in the ways in which she has been, like, you know, sort of slut-shamed or kind of been punished for her sexuality, are there ways in which that punishment can be kind of, you know, sort of erased and she can, you know, be allowed to be sexual with no repercussions? Or I'm not exactly sure what I'm trying to ask. Or maybe even she can be not necessarily problematic or dangerous, but in what way can a woman basically enjoy sort of, you know, the sexual dominance that has defined a male sexuality? And I'll stop you before you say Fifty Shades of Grey, because honestly, that's a very, like, the film series that I've seen, and yes, I've seen all two of them. It's expressively inconsistent. Just like, you know, like she's intrigued in what's his face's, you know, sort of like BDSM life, but then she kind of goes away. Like, the first film ends with, like, him spanking her, and that was just too much for her. And then, like, she says, never see me again. And then in the next movie, it's like, well, I won't do it to you again. Okay. And then she's like, well, do it to me again. And then, like, he does it. And then, like, nothing happens. Like, there's no sort of, like, forward progression with her interests. So yeah. It's like, well, she's good. She's a good girl because she doesn't really commit to it. Mm-hmm. But, I don't know. I know for a fact that Jan could tell me a lot more about fiction in terms of, you know, women owning their sexuality in ways which film doesn't necessarily, mainstream film doesn't necessarily show. But yeah, I don't know if I have any other additional thoughts to her points, but I think it is. I'd like to revisit this email when we do that episode very soon.
Yeah, absolutely.
So yeah, thank you very much for emailing in, Mary. And I would enjoy, not that this is, you know, a requisite of you, but like, I love the fact that, like, you know, from one episode to another, we get consistent emails, and consistent, really, really well thought out emails. So if you guys have any continuing thoughts on this or any other episode or talking point, email in at qnoanswers@gmail.com. Thanks a lot.
Men die out many years ago.
With all these women around, they'll probably nag to death. Are you with me, fellas?
Here's stadium where our women basketball teams play.
We know can dunk, but good fundamentals.
That more fun to watch.
Oh, God, you're killing me.
So, for this episode, we're going to talk about bias, and one of the very first episodes, I think the final episode that we recorded before we actually started publishing them was about bias in the media and how the news media might or can start to become unbiased or how it could, might be unbiased.
Oh wow, I wonder how that one holds up.
Yeah, I actually started trying to listen to it, but I ran out of time. And I don't know if it actually got anywhere in the first 10 minutes.
it was just so boring. It's like, God, these guys.
No, it was cool, but like I kind of want to like really get to the heart of bias in and of itself. Personally, for me, I think, you know, 2017 was sort of our year of collective shock, which lent itself to a collective sort of convalescence when it came to sort of like, you know, online talk, you know, hot topics or hot takes or whatever and talking points. I mean we were all pretty reactionary to a lot of things and you know, naturally so. But I think that, like, a year has passed between the 2016 election and now. We have to do something. And I think the first thing that I think is not only relevant to this podcast, but, you know, towards the large conversation, the conversation at large, is kind of recognizing how we differentiate between bias and genuine concern for morality. And I've been thinking about this a lot because I've finally gotten to the point where, like, in my mind, Republicans, like, or at least modern Republicans that are working right now, are thoroughly evil. To kind of, you know, put you in the hot light and kind of use the phrase you said, they align with our shared understanding of what evil is. Which I really love how that was phrased. And like, I really, with every week, I can't shake that from my, you know, almost 30 years of understanding what good and evil is. And I feel bad because, you know, politics shouldn't be divvied up this way. There should be sort of, you know, different perspectives on reaching a mutually attained goal. Like just differences of opinion. But, like, it's gotten to the point now where it's like, no, you know, there's nothing inherently positive about the Trump administration at all. And everybody who kind of endorses him with, you know, sort of like shit-eating grin are just as bad, if not worse. And I say that, and it just sounds like your basic, you know, liberal, you know, kind of like extremism or whatever that's being portrayed in television cartoons. But I'm not lying, I mean that. And I don't like feeling that way. And to me, it's a constant case of, you know, am I just being swallowed up by the hive mind or with that bias? Or is reality kind of crashing in and evaporating what was or what could have been just partisan bias? So that's kind of like where I'm coming from for this issue. And to me, it's sort of like, you know, a very urgent imperative that we kind of figure this out before we kind of move along, because I have ideas for this show in future episodes that could really that it's important to get right from the onset, and it's important to know, you know, what kind of mentality I would be armed with going into those episodes. To what degree, if at all, and feel free to say this, it hasn't, has this kind of, you know, kind of swum into your head, Harry?
A lot, and I think that you kind of finally put into words for me that kind of anxiety of not so much like action and reaction, but, you know, as the Republicans kind of characterize themselves, or Republican voters and supporters and politicians, like, it, you do sense yourself kind of drifting towards a template of what a liberal is, and or rather what a liberal is perceived to be. And you were kind of just, you know, drifting there inexorably, like as if on, you know, a piece of driftwood, or perhaps yes. Paul Walker's car in the third movie. Oh, actually, that was what is the guy's name? that guy drifting. And it's frustrating because you feel yourself kind of losing your agency in a conversation that you haven't actually had, because who's really crossing the aisle. And you don't want to lose that part. But at the same time, these guys are just so absurd that to try to be, I don't know, like, to try to give them any ground feels, as we mentioned in an earlier episode, like centrism. And so I think the kind of middle ground for us right now, and something that, I mean, well, this episode is going to be about what we can do immediately, which is kind of suss out our biases and see if we are kind of moving towards that template as ourselves or as part of a hive mind. And how we can kind of, you know, distinguish our individuality. But also, I mean, I'm very interested in the idea that understanding and opposing political ideology and trying to really flesh out what they are, what their motivations are, isn't inherently sympathizing or empathizing with that position. Because it, to my mind, it's all about the art of war and understanding your enemy. But to do that, and to do that on an open public forum like social media, you will be met with, you could be seen as somebody who is trying to cross the aisle in that way that Trevor Noah did so famously. He's like the prophet or something.
Well, thankfully, I was given an example today on Facebook where a friend of mine who identifies as conservative posted a status where he was basically laughing, like LOL, the people who really think that there is a singular nuclear button that could, you know, fire a nuclear weapon or whatever, but in referencing, you know, our president's insane tweet over the weekend, basically laughing at the people who were concerned about that. And I said, you know, like, that's not funny. And like-minded friends of mine had kind of chimed in with similar thoughts, and he was trying to backpedal, saying that, like, he was not necessarily endorsing the president's tweets, but just merely laughing at the lack of information that people were kind of getting fretted over. And I said, listen, you know, that's not what we talk about. You know, whether people are ignorant or not to believe that there's an actual red button, that's always been sort of, you know, the agreed upon metaphor for the power that he holds. Yep. You know, that's not good enough of a talking point to kind of, you know, utter in a situation where the president, you know, unless the listener isn't aware, basically played paper football with saying, oh, Kim Jong-un brags about his nuclear weapon, but I assure you, mine's bigger, and it works. So we have this very, you know, kind of like juvenile expression of the power dynamic that Trump enjoys, and also just like kind of playing, you know, like laughingly throwing out the notion of just nuclear holocaust against the entire country. That's not funny, and like, no serious politician or leader of a country who is sane would ever do that. And to bring about, oh, LOL, the people who think that, like, you know, he was being serious or whatever, it's like, this would never come up under any other president in the history of American politics. And to me, it felt like a very strained and not well thought out just attempt to remain partisan without getting into like, strict details. And he was instantly just caught on that. And it's like, you know, and a friend of mine said, you know, I hate saying this, but this is a clear instance of if Obama had said this exact same thing, you would be posting differently. And that's exactly how I feel, where it's like, yeah, that would be the case. No one would tolerate this under any president, but, you know, for whatever reason, Trump has really inspired a lot of people to just stick in the ground, and no matter what he does, just defend him. I suppose, you know, with like 300 million people in America, that's correct? Or is it?
Yeah, roughly. Yeah.
You know, there's a lot, that's a lot of people, so there's going to be some people who are going to do that. But, like, even still, like, I mean, that's irrational and ridiculous. But that's kind of what I'm talking about here. It's like the, you know, this is not, this shouldn't be a political issue or an issue where we kind of stay by our man.
Right.
This is an instance of seriously fearing what we have to deal with in terms of a leader for the country and dealing with his sort of, you know, knee-jerk reactions at the slightest sort of insult as towards his pride and his manhood, and not someone not recognizing that for what it is and just choosing to say, okay, I can be a good Republican by sort of, you know, posting this sort of like lack, you know, this sort of like hollow intellectual superiority. Like everyone knows that, you know, there's not an actual button, and that's just such like a misfire in terms of where you insert your supposed intellectual superiority over anybody. And that to me is like okay, this is exactly what I'm talking about here. Like this is just, I mean, that this is obviously biased innately, but to me it's like this kind of knee-jerk partisanship is going to get people killed, because you know things are not being taken as seriously, so the wrong things will be taken seriously, such as, you know, allegiance to such ridiculous, you know, loyalty to the president. You know, you can be a Republican all you want, but like, you know, you like being loyal to the president in this instance of saying, oh, he's actually smarter than you guys really think, is dumb, because he is not.
Right.
And that to me is I feel like I don't necessarily deal with that kind of stuff every day, but like it happens every day, and has driven me insane to where I'm now currently insane.
Well, it's easier for Democrats because we had gone so long with crappy candidates. Well, I guess it was just Kerry, but I mean, Al Gore wasn't that bad. He was kind of the, I don't know, but I mean, until Barack Obama, it was like, who do we throw our weight behind? Certainly not Hillary Clinton. But then, I mean, just as an aside, and I realize we're not really talking about this, but it is kind of fascinating to compare our situation today with Ronald Reagan's situation and the Cold War and all that, where, you know, that was about a fear of communism, that we could be kind of overtaken by, communists, whether in Russia or China. I mean, that was the basis of the Vietnam War, and it was the legacy of World War II. It was everything. It was huge. Whether or not that justifies the use of nuclear weapons, because I don't think probably anything does. That is like the glitch in humanity. But still, I mean, it like justifiable to an extent, even in a military paradigm. But if you look at it now, like what are we fearing from North Korea? We're fearing that they're going to fire a nuclear missile at America or at one of our allies. But honestly, you know, people who are American are probably more concerned about themselves. I mean, that's not crazy. Mm-hmm. But so we're going to combat that by threatening to fire a missile, and basically we're fighting the fear of nuclear war with the threat of nuclear war. Like it's just so stupid. And then you see these comments on variously on Twitter, people being like, you know, I'm glad we have a president who's like willing to stand up for us and not back down.
But like,
like that's the issue. It's not even like
what president wouldn't do that.
Well, I mean, it's just
not this way. Yeah.
Well, there's no other political motive. There's no fear of communism this time. It's just about manhood.
Yeah, exactly. It's that toxic masculinity where, like, you know, real leadership is willing to murder people and not caring that you do it. Because, you know, as terrifying and awful as, like, Kim Jong-un's regime in North Korea's military are and how they pose a threat to the world, you know, I think the majority of people wouldn't vote to say like let's just murder everybody. Right. They'd rather, you know, have them no access to nuclear weapons and basically make it so where they're not enslaving, you know, North Korea and threatening South Korea all the time. Like I don't think anybody's, you know, Democrat or Republican would say, okay, yeah, just kill them all. You know, get them out of our way because we're not, you know, King Herod or whatever. I don't know. Right. I don't know my Bible. So, but I mean, to me, it's like, What do you make of that type of, you know, like feeble attempt at partisanship and you know, that sort of bias towards one's own political party, no matter what they're actually saying? It's almost as though that, like, just he it's almost that he responded without actually reading the tweet or whatever. It's just like, oh, I have to jump in here and do my duty more so than, like, you know, recognize the larger, more dangerous context?
I mean, I think there's two things here right off the bat, and one of them is that this is actually a place where we share some commonalities with our enemies, which is to say that a lot of the time, this is a competition, and it's about being right. And being right is so much more important than anything else. I feel like that's kind of the foundation for Trump supporters, especially now, who are human. They can see what's going on, but they don't want to admit that they were wrong. I mean, all the rhetoric going into the campaign and all that is just like it was so much about a narrative of poor white voters finally reclaiming America. And if the Southern strategy, like they don't want the reality to be that politicians have always been manipulating their latent or non-latent racism into voting profit, because they also don't want to realize that they are racist. There's just a whole it's like a Matryoshka doll of worm cans that they don't want to open.
Yeah.
And so it's so to think that like, oh, there's a lot riding on them being right. I can begin to see why absurdity is kind of maintained. And in the same way, that kind of partisanship in the face of absurdity is it has root principle of enforcement that is in all of our lives, which we'll probably talk about if we talk about this chart that you brought up about biases or cognitive biases. But, you know, I mean, I see it a lot on Twitter, of course. And this is something we've talked about before where, you know, for me, it's going to be Lexi Alexander, where if she says something, then I'm not going to say a certain thing. Like, you know, she becomes this kind of guiding authority that affects me in a way that I want to be affected because I want to let other voices in. But at the same time, like I become afraid to perhaps break from a party line that is then created. And that's, you know, that is difficult because it's not just partisanship for the sake of partisanship. It's about identity. It's about there's emotion behind this. There's humanity behind this, even if it is on its face very inhuman. But a lot of it is like, I mean, it all comes back to the core of conservatism. Thank you. Which is security for family or whatever. Like the conservative ideology is born of love at the center, even if it balloons into this absurd self-destructive philosophy. But, you know, I guess that's kind of an aside anyway. But like, yeah, I mean, the adherence to a strict party line, I see that in my own life from being like, I don't want to say something that will upset somebody I really like or whose opinion of me I value.
Yeah, I experienced that recently. I think Noah Berlatsky had posted posted something about race and superheroes, and he said something that was like incontrovertibly wrong, like saying that like fans of Miles Morales Spider-Man were hoping for him to show up in Spider-Man Homecoming, but were disappointed when a white Tom Holland was cast. And I was like, dude, like no one was expecting him in Homecoming. He was in Civil War. And like I kind of hesitated to put to post that because like I feel that like I don't like not that I fear, you know, blowback from Berlatsky necessarily, but like it's sort of like the identity of, you know, the argument. I'm absolutely all for more diversity in superheroes, but it's like pointing something out, like, can be, I've seen it be misconstrued by other people who are just a lot more kind of like, you know, attack dog on it.
Yeah.
But no, he's probably like, oh no, you're right. That I don't know. That was a poor phrasing on my part or whatever. And that was it. But I remember that kind of, that sort of anxiety and how bad the situation has become, because that also kind of speaks to, you know, radical liberals and their, you know, I guess like people on Twitter and their propensity.
Call out culture
and that kind of stuff. I was asking my brother as we were driving back to the airport today, you know, how would one avoid bias and separate it from, you know, basic human morality and good and evil? And you mentioned the art of war. I mean, he said in his opinion, it would be to like just understand the opposition's argument and see what kind of where it comes from. And you know, it's one thing to have an argument, but if it's based in illogic in blind loyalty and partisanship, then have they lost the moral high ground? And I don't know, I feel that they would have, because that's just kind of being childish, you know, just trying to urge onto the same on your person's side without really caring about, you know, the larger context that would help everybody, as every politician would want to say. You know, I think most politicians would want to serve all Americans, although I know as a, you know, and of course, you know, liberals rather serve liberals because to further their causes. But like, I would imagine that recent history has shown that Republicans are much more interested in helping Republicans based on, you know, how different votes and laws have passed and all that kind of stuff. Anyways, before I speak too much on something I don't know thoroughly about, I think that, like, when we understand that, it does become sort of, because there is a lot of, you know, us using the straw man argument from you know, sort of straw man idiot examples, say this is why they're crazy or whatever, but that's not the kind of situation we're talking about here. And when it comes to, you know, sort of like the White House and a lot of public policy and that kind of stuff, like Trump had, like, recently he had fired everybody what had to do with, like, sort of like HIV research.
Oh, nice.
Were you aware of that? It was something to do with that.
I don't know.
But it was just that kind of thing where it's like, there's no real excuse for this. Yeah. None whatsoever. And, you know, that marches along with, I mean, that's almost like 80s-ish Reagan level sort of like, homophobia right there. It's from another, like, you know, we had since evolved from that type of social interaction. That it's like, you know, I don't even know who he's sort of working for anymore. And, you know, it's like Dave Chappelle said, not to really quote Dave Chappelle, but in this instance, but he was right when he said, you know, he's not working for the lower class people, he's working for the higher class people. I don't know. I mean, I don't want to make this whole thing just one big, you know. It's more than the Trump administration necessarily. It is sort of about kind of checking these biases and kind of seeing how one's argument can kind of end up hurting themselves. You talked to me before recording about looking up some examples of, like, you know, on the other side of the political fence. Were you planning on talking about those tonight? If not, I can always edit this out.
not really. I mean, I'm trying to think now. Shit. In that case, that was more people who were just kind of more extreme than us in terms of being lefties. Because I was doing some research on the Matrix sequels, and I found out that Cornel West was one of the counselors.
I read that tonight too, and I was like, what the fuck?
Yeah. Oh my god. I was like, oh wow. And so it wasn't his beef with Ta-Nehisi Coates that got me interested in researching him. It was the Matrix. But
it was, you know, opposite for me.
I mean, what is all those? It's people like, you know, the Young Turks and Abby Martin, who I just discovered yesterday, and the Empire Files. Like, mm-hmm. People who are, they kind of just seem contrarian a lot of the times. But I mean, you know, these are people who I feel like they are at least kind of more interested in, like, libertarians than we would be. And, you know, I feel like it was Cornel West who was, like, really, like, heavily critical of Barack Obama throughout the...
Absolutely he was.
I don't know about that. And and I feel like it's all the... Well, I didn't do enough research to really characterize the nature of the criticism, but it was the same thing for this other person, Abby Martin, who is... not necessarily an intellectual, but a journalist who kind of, like, really, like, gets in there. Is one of those crazy, like, citizen journalists who, like, gets arrested at the DNC. I feel like she was critical of, like, Hillary Clinton. And when it comes to Hillary Clinton and being critical of Hillary Clinton, like, that has been kind of a wound for me for a long time, just because I would always try to make the issue so much simpler, and that it was just about man versus woman. And so when I hear anything about how, like, you know, she was not so good with her policies in the Middle East, so you get a lot of blowback from people who are from Arab countries, or she was, legitimate criticism that I felt like we're still at their core rooted in gender inequality, because ultimately, there was this kind of lack of focus on the big picture, which is the election of the first female president, which, I mean, I don't think anybody would argue that Hillary Clinton would be a better president than Donald Trump. I think it was just a matter of people not wanting to vote or endorse Hillary Clinton as the president. And I don't know really where I'm going with this, other than just to kind of Well, yeah, it's very frustrating. But I feel like a lot of people use their vote as an expression of their First Amendment rights, and I just don't. It's a fucking tool. You're playing strategy. What is that game called? Stratego.
Stratego. Stratego. I can't say like that word.
I know, I can't say it all of a sudden.
Strategio?
Strategio.
No, I was so pissed off at a friend of mine when she like proudly admitted that she didn't vote because they were just as bad or whatever. And it's
old Bioshock Infinite argument.
If you say so.
Video game nerd.
Well, I do imagine that people who didn't vote honestly thought that, like, you know, America would save them, the voting American would save them and, you know, vote for the most obvious candidate, but, like, that really kind of just fucked over the country, because everyone who didn't vote were smart-ass enough to think that, you know, oh, they really, you know, you have Hillary Clinton who has these policies and this sort of, you know, this sort of record that I don't like, and Donald Trump who's obviously bad. No one would ever say that Donald Trump is objectively good, but like I saw the same shit go on like the day of the Alabama election between Roy Moore and Doug Jones. I heard people on the radio say, "I don't know who to vote for," and that shit drives me crazy. It's like,
yeah,
you know, there was this very strange Republican who was like saying, "Yeah, I've always voted Republican," and Doug Jones is pro-choice, so it really hurts for me to vote for him. But that doesn't mean that I'm automatically going to vote for Roy Moore either. And you know, of course, for myself, that's kind of a thing where it's like, I can't speak to that because abortion is not a topic that we've necessarily tackled, and I don't really want to demean people who are pro-life exactly. But at the same time, well, no, I mean,
I'm just fucking with you. I'm very passionate about that, but still, I get you.
I am pro-choice, but like, that's not a situation where I write off, oh, they're obviously wrong. I mean, a lot of people, like Mike Huckabee, are crazy in how they kind of express that. But you know, that's not a position that I'm going to demonize as just for the straw man's. But the Roy Moore versus Doug Jones thing was again a situation of, you know, once the dust had settled, I was not depressed. I was elated that Doug Jones won, but. It's just like, you know, this is how it is now. We had to, like, you know, pat ourselves on the back and shake each other's hands that we didn't vote a fucking, you know, self-congratulatory pedophile into public. Like, it's that bad where people, like, just, like told themselves, I don't know who's worse. And that, to me, is like, you got, like people just like, kind of abandon their standards for this false sense of themselves. Where, like, you know, I'm being honest with myself, I don't know who to vote for, when I feel that, like, you know, okay, seriously. This is not a scenario where you have this whole, like, you know, like, bad guy versus bad guy kind of scenario. To me, it's like, yeah, what will this vote stand for? What will this vote speak of not only the country or the district where, you know, you're voting for, but you know, who you are as a person. And that's always what bothered me about a friend who, like, voted for Trump. It's like, but you have a daughter, you know, like how can you, when that daughter grows up in recent history class this election, how can you tell them that you voted for this person? How can you, because it's, there's no way that this era is going to go down positively unless it brings about, you know, a whole slew of, you know, kind of aftershocks in, you know, democracy and liberal votes or whatever, because it's just not, there's just nothing positive that's come from it. So to me, it's. I suppose people are looking at it differently. It's not, you know, what they would stand for. It's not what they're concerned with. They're more concerned with sort of the here and now and the more immediate reaction. But, like, I don't know. Like, the whole Hillary Clinton thing is about as bad as the whole Barack Obama thing ever got. And I've probably said on this podcast before, but, like, at first with the whole Obama thing, I was like, well, we did bash on Bush Jr. for during his second term. Yes, I guess, you know, Republicans can kind of take it out on themselves, kind of, you know, just start bashing him, I suppose. It's only fair. Of course, I was much younger and not as savvy of how things work, but now it's like, oh, yeah, no, that was all racist, I see. So it's one of those things where it's like, these things, to my mind, are examples of how a lot of things should not be conversation, but they're coming up as sort of these sort of like shoulder-to-shoulder, bare-bones, you know, ride-or-die arguments that are really kind of, you know, erasing the nature of biases. Like, biases, you know, are kind of going away because things are so obvious. And that's kind of scary because they kind of shrinks down our worldview as to, you know, it kind of erases the options we have in terms of having an opinion. And I think that's a very real threat that, like, you know, this sort of, because what kind of spurred the song was the whole, like, you know, usherance of fake news or whatever, which is just insane. I mean, it's the most successful propaganda campaign since, I think, like, I took a propaganda class, so I'm thinking like World War II or whatever.
Yeah.
It is that powerful, and people will genuinely believe it. People who listen to this will genuinely believe in that kind of thing. I mean, even I will, because there are news outlets that are reporting things that aren't true that you can technically call fake news, but that fake news is a term of you know, the Trump administration, so I don't want to call it that. I just want to call it bullshit. So I want to choke the rambling out of my throat and give you the floor, but like, I don't know, like those were instances of me losing the fight for my mind in the erasure of bias from the public conversation.
Well, I mean, it's certainly been said, but Roy Moore is just so comparable to Donald Trump, and he essentially is the same candidate, but without the help of Russian meddling, but also plus pedophile, which is slightly more, of a taboo than sexual assault generally. Mm-hmm. And it's just like it is disheartening also, just because like the people who voted for him or who couldn't decide were just like that wasn't a factor. And for the people who voted against him, like, it's not supposed to be like, I mean, certainly you can say I don't want to vote for a pedophile, like, that's, I'm not going to hold that against you, but more so I think it was supposed to be, I don't want a pedophile making decisions. And there's a very nuanced, like, very, very subtle difference between those two ideas. Which is that, so I guess it's like your vote actually doesn't have the kind of lofty goals about identity. It's just, it's strictly about what it's going to do. It is a piece of currency. Mm-hmm. I too am glad that in that very weird glad kind of mode that Doug Jones won. And it's interesting to see, you know, come Oscar season, if he wins the Oscar for The Shape of Water, Andy Serkis is going to be fucking pissed.
I see what you did there.
Yeah, wah, wah, wah.
I saw you see that.
Oh, God. It's pretty good.
Oh, you just say, okay. So that's my worry. Like, these are situations that I feel 2 years ago, or almost 2 years ago when we started this podcast, I guess like a year and a half ago, we couldn't imagine. And, you know, even when things are kind of getting crazy, you know, there was a whole, the police shootings of unarmed black men, all the kind of stuff, you know, these guys kind of constantly getting off on getting acquitted for all these charges, that kind of stuff. Like that craziness had begun to kind of resurface in, you know, the public eye, but, you know, like oh, we didn't put a pedophile in office or whatever. I mean, that should be, like, it'd be a wake-up call. I don't know.
When you say it like that, it is incredibly sad. It's just like, what the fuck?
I mean, but that's
like a joke.
But like, I mean, this is the first month in this new year. We can't sit on our hands and just complain about this kind of stuff. What do? We got to do something. And you know, of course, you know, before we get to start voting and stuff like that, we have to kind of recognize, I guess, the dispersion of information. Recognizing, you know, who these people are. Of course, it's also recognizing who we are as people. What do we stand for?
Yeah.
And, you know, if our vote has to mean anything, you know, what would that be? And, you know, what is generally agreed upon to be bad and evil and irredeemable? You know, you should, and I think that, like, the mindset I'm coming from is that you should not reward somebody with public office and voting for them who has been an admitted pedophile. And people say, well, he didn't admit to it, but yeah, he freely, like said on Hannity's show, you know, oh, well, you know, dating girls and that, verbatim, basically.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many political scandals that you can't substantiate over history. I mean, I just understand this apocryphally, but, you know, why does it even need such, like, legal confirmation? Why can't a scandal be enough anymore? And obviously we know the answer, but still.
Also, to kind of go back to what you kind of mentioning to Cornel West, I am actually pretty familiar with Cornel West. I was very aware of his kind of like bitchings about Obama in the last, and like the second, his second term mainly. I don't know if you're aware of this, but, you know, of course, recently was, you know, the Ta-Nehisi Coates leaving Twitter because of the Guardian post that Cornel West made about We Were 8 Years in Power, saying, you know, this book, you know, in his view sucks because this doesn't mention, you know, Wall Street or anything. Yeah. Like, Cornel, I mean, I don't know if you know where we're aware of this, but in 2015, I explicitly remember when Michael Eric Dyson came out with, I don't know if it's called The Fall of Cornel West or whatever, but it was basically a 10,000-word sort of expression on how Cornel West has lost his goddamn mind. Mm-hmm. And how they were both friends, you know, they both kind of were in the same circles. And Cornel was very much a black the black intellectual of the 20th century, someone to be completely admired and read upon. I mean, like his book Race Matters, which I've not read, is sort of, you know, sort of like the foundation for which a lot of modern black intellectuals, like Dyson, like Coates, you know, kind of stem from. But Dyson spoke about how his. And of course, it's sort of, you know, this might be kind of seen as sort of gossip or whatever, but like basically, his pride and his ego have really kind of taken over how he expresses himself in ways which are completely antithetical towards helping any community, and sort of kind of seen as self serving. Like he voted for he was a Ralph Nader man during the 2004 election. But eventually convinced others to vote for John Kerry, even though he kind of really didn't like John Kerry. It was very much a kind of a Hillary Clinton kind of thing, where he didn't really like him, but he ended up voting for him anyway. Kind of recognized, you know, that was a better thing to do. But he could not bring himself to vote for Hillary Clinton for basically those reasons. But more kind of ridiculously, like it was pretty much agreed upon by everybody who was there that like he really. Was in his feelings that Obama did not invite him to the president, like White House dinner or whatever.
Bum 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 bum.
Here on the Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
Since then had called Obama out as, you know, a Rockefeller Republican in blackface, and, you know, the drone president, the Wall Street president, all this kind of stuff, and really kind of just attacking his blackness.
Yeah.
And whereas, you know, guys like Tavis Smiley, who, you know, rest in peace, have attacked Obama for his lack of, you know, helping the poor, which is in some ways, you know, that's a legitimate criticism. I think like it's been agreed upon by many, including myself, who has read upon this kind of stuff, that West's assailment of Obama is primarily basically kind of just due to hurt feelings and a lack of sort of shared resources from one black president to a black intellectual. And his recent attack on Ta-Nehisi Coates is sort of the same thing, since Ta-Nehisi Coates is sort of in vogue right now, kind of seen as, like, you know, the black intellectual of our times, with the case of reparations, Between the World and Me, and We Were 8 Years in Power. It's sort of seen as sort of this very petty kind of takedown from one guy, you know, from an elder statesman to sort of a young buck coming up. And I'd agree with that, because if you read his takedown but his argument in The Guardian is really hollow. It's barely 1,000 words. It's short. And it's like, well, he doesn't talk about, you know, he's so negative. He doesn't talk about how black people kind of come up, you know, kind of fighting back with this. He doesn't know about that. He doesn't talk about sexism. He doesn't talk about homophobia or whatever. Whereas it's like, you know, any idiot who cared about this would see that he has talked about that elsewhere. Just because that's not the focus of this one book doesn't mean he's never focused upon it. It's that kind of, you know, very kind of hollow reading, which shows a lack of understanding. And it's like, how much does ego play into it? You know, how much the personal bias in the way of, you know, perception, I suppose. And of course, this is not so much like, you know, a lending towards evil. But I guess it in some ways is sort of the kind of thing, like my friend on Facebook, who sort of like, you know, is concerned about identity in a way, and how one can come off, you know, using the veneer of intellectual superiority to basically cloud and kind of. Have people gang up on somebody else, or kind of, you know, kind of like flip the script and kind of have other people, you know, kind of put on site, in the way that, you know, like Coates did. You know, the breaking point for him was when fucking Richard Spencer retweeted Cornel West's post on Twitter.
Oh man,
ah, God.
But I'm sorry.
Other
than that, wait, what were you gonna say?
Well, I mean, that's in that way where like ego. Seemingly, I kind of buy this. I'm not subscribing to somebody else's argument. Ego really plays into bias in a way which kind of clouds men's minds, to use a phrase. Like, I suppose in a way that's what we're trying to kind of keep against. Not so much for ourselves, but that to me is sort of seen as like almost not really similarity, but like, you know, almost kind of a Magneto way of, you know, once our ally, now our enemy kind of thing, where you're not fucking helping anybody. but what were you going to say?
I mean, with the West versus Coates thing was definitely, exactly what we were talking about earlier in terms of like, you know, where these biases come from sometimes is that we kind of invest in online personalities and calibrate our personas in a certain way to do so. And that, you know, if we were to make, for example, a Ryan Murphy FX drama about this unfolding quote unquote beef, you know, American Crime Story, Coates versus West, like
fucking one of the awesome.
that would be pretty good. But one of the episodes would definitely be about the reaction of people. I mean, West called Coates, among other things, neoliberal. Yeah. And so he's giving his audience the kind of the simplified tools to attack this guy. And it becomes the kind of like Bill Nye versus Ken Ham thing, which is like, oh man, John Oliver destroys Donald Trump in a debate or like a video or something. Or like, you know, when John Stewart debates Bill O'Reilly for the 11th time, it's like, oh man, watch him destroy it. Or, you know, the Richard Dawkins destroys atheist woman. It's always a woman or not atheist, a Christian woman in the audience.
Yeah.
And it's just like this fucking like this arena or like pro sportsification of political discourse is so American in the most worst way possible. It's just but it is a kind of extreme example of, you know, not being able to break outside of your lines, because it's essentially fandom at this point. You're not going to be able to kind of understand the complexities or whatever the situation of Coates or jump into his POV or to see that West's criticism of him is hollow because you have the T-shirt and you're not going to throw that away. And so it's just another layer of fucking absurdity that creates this like molted shell or unmolted, I guess. Well, I don't know entomology. You didn't know something earlier. I don't know entomology. What are we doing? What do we know?
Do it live.
If not that, then what? Yeah.
Has there been a situation where you really liked somebody or admired somebody, not romantically, but in terms of like, you know, like what they represented or what they said or how they expressed themselves? And sort of an undressing of the emperor thing happened where they're either wrong or someone pointed out something about them that you didn't want to necessarily subscribe in anymore. And, you know, you did your work and you found out that was true, and your opinion of the person either changed or went away or was altered. So is there an instance where, like, you know, you didn't play partisan and you weren't instantly just standing for your home team? Has that ever happened?
I wonder, because I feel like I've lucked out a lot, because I don't really fall in love with too many people. I didn't really give a shit about George Takei. Like, as an Asian American, he was never one of my guys. I don't really have a guy in that department. And so when it came out that he was both, I guess, a pervert and a pedophile, whatever, like, I just wish he would go away. But fucking Steve Bloom and Mary McGlynn keep retweeting him onto my goddamn feed, and I can't unfollow them. So maybe it's them who's going to – no. They're fine.
Leave them alone.
Yes. Arguably Hillary Clinton, although I never really broke from an allegiance to Hillary Clinton. I just, again, that's like the oldest wound that I'm just never going to get over, and it's going to make me a twat, basically, I guess. I don't know. I feel like this is something that's happened a lot for people in video games, and I know there was an account, an essay that I read a long time ago by Maddie Myers, who's a video game critic who I really like, who talked about growing up and the first thing that kind of invited her into fandom as a video gamer was Penny Arcade. And those guys were huge for years and years and years, and they were kind of the first people to popularize nerdery in the way that – in the kind of like Will Wheaton, Dan Harmon kind of way. Mm-hmm. They were kind of the first. Pioneers in that regard, and they do PAX West and PAX East, like huge game conventions that people debut their stuff at. And then it came out that they were like, you know, you're kind of prototypical at this point, video game dick who like made a bunch of really blue sexist jokes and just never apologized and just doubled down until there was just nothing left, and they were just little minuscule molecules floating around, and nobody and for Miss Myers, it was really hard to kind of reconcile that her hero had kind of destroyed themselves in that way, or exposed themselves as a monster. And for me, I can't think of any examples. So I guess I would just reverse that question to you. Do you have anybody like that?
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I feel as though I don't know. I was ever like kind of just like shaking or whatever. I think by the time I got to a certain age, I was okay with some people. Like I don't know. Like when people kind of point out that like Obama was like kind of sort of. You know, okaying drones kind of strike into like civilian field areas in Iraq or whatever. Like, I understand that really sucks and kind of needs to be confronted with. And like, I feel that like that was one of those instances that kind of made me feel that like, and, you know, obviously nobody's perfect or whatever, but everybody. It didn't make me like hate him at all, but it was one of those things where it's like, you know, there's going to be a serious flaw with everybody, and you have to kind of like, you know. Take that, not take it with a grain of salt, but like, you know, kind of accept that and kind of confront it properly, without, you know, kind of like reversing your entire opinion on them. Because I wasn't necessarily asking if you like somebody and then you turn out to hate them.
Okay.
That wasn't really what I was trying to say. I was trying to say you at least realize that there's something wrong with what they kind of, you know, do or kind of express or whatever, and don't just kind of just make up excuses for them, I suppose. Mm. I'm trying to think if there's a situation. I know there are situations. I feel like I need more time.
Call a friend.
Fool that I am.
Well, I guess because like with Lexi Alexander, she's half Arab, half German, and so she talks about Palestine because I think that's like where that's part of her heritage. And you know, she talks about like, you know, because a lot of Israelis are kind of anti. Israeli occupation of Palestine. This is something that I really need to know more about, but that is an issue that was never really real to me. And then I, you know, follow both Lexi Alexander and people like Rachel Bloom and Aline Rosh McKenna and people who are Jewish and a lot of people who have commented on my videos, because I remember I made some crack about, well, I mean, it wasn't a crack, it was just to say that Rachel Bloom is a white person, and people took exception to that because she's Jewish. And I had never understood this distinction. I don't understand Jewish as an ethnicity. But it was good to kind of understand that. But still, like, I can't take anybody at face value on that debate anymore, just because it's so goddamn complex. Not the issue itself, which is complex in its own right, but is more simpler than most Americans want to believe, just because we don't want to think about it. But which is fine. Well, it's not fine, but I understand it. But, you know, it's like, at what point does criticism of Israel become anti-Semitism? Like, what is that distinction? Like, that's got to be the first part of that conversation. And because that doesn't happen, I just feel like I guess my eyes are a little bit more clear. Like, I can't jump to one side either way. Not to say that Rachel Bloom or Arlene Rosh McKenna is even in this argument, although they did have that one line in the jab battle. Jap being a word that is actually real, or a term meaning Jewish American princess.
American princess, yeah.
But yeah, so I guess that's kind of an example. Did I buy you enough time?
No, but I don't know. I mean, it's a pretty open secret that I've told you before that Rebecca Sugar like had drawn like erotic pictures of previously presented cartoon characters.
That's awesome.
And I remember reading about that, then seeing it for myself, and kind of like really not caring for the first time. Like not caring. Although maybe I don't know. maybe my not caring started with like Bruce Timm's release of like, you know, his own personal like kind of nude artist collection. At Comic-Con, which I thought was, you know, whatever. But I still kind of think it's whatever.
It didn't even get hard. It's like, whatever.
All right, sure. Well, yeah, the cartoon characters. But I don't know. I'm trying to think scenarios where it's like, you know, I really admire this person, and I think they're wrong, but it doesn't, you know, that doesn't revoke this or that or whatever. I don't.
Yeah.
No. Go ahead.
Well, this is the question, right? Because... Yeah. It's so frustrating, it just in general, that – I mean, and this kind of relates to call-out culture too, that mm-hmm. our capacity for evaluating who matters has to move beyond pass fail. It has to be more nuanced than I don't like this person today for whatever it is they just said, so yeah, they're gone forever. We have to be able to accept people, especially people on the same side of the spectrum, politically speaking, or whichever.
Yeah.
No,
I'm my brother and I actually having a conversation about this the other day. Like, he was saying that, like, he had made himself aware of Harry Potter fandom and how like some have, like, turned against, or they've turned their backs on J.K. Rowling.
Yeah.
Because, like, I wasn't really aware of this, but, like, I got one instance, you know, they didn't like her because she keeps on updating, like, characteristics of the houses. Like, if you're a Slytherin, you're also this. It's like, and the person's like, well, I'm not like that at all. Stop doing that. Which is hilarious. I actually kind of understand that that'd be a little annoying. But, like,
sure.
So, he said that, like, someone didn't like the fact that, like, I guess in the Fantastic Beasts film, which I've not seen, there was some sort of, like, racist Native American magic stuff going on, which, I mean, if that's true, then that's the case, and it's racist, and she should not do it again or apologize for it. And, like, she hadn't spoken about it when people were calling her out on it, but people were saying, like, you know, because of this, I will never like her again, and that, to me, that kind of stuff to me doesn't feel very, I don't know, you know, like not to erase, you know, racism against Native Americans, but, like, I feel as though that, like, in the conversation of rectifying such a thing, you gotta be able to, if you like this person so much in the beginning, you can't kill them when that happens. You know, it's not. I can't imagine it was legitimately, like, I can't imagine it was anything like, you know, the animated Peter Pan or whatever. But even in the worst case scenario, I think she would be open to, you know, open to critique about that. And if she's not, if she's just, you know, la la la, I don't hear you, and I'm going to do this again, then sure, absolutely, you know, that she's a terrible person. But from what you were telling me, it didn't seem very very nuanced or realistic coming from a lot of these very kind of reactionary fans who,
right,
you know, were kind of, you know, dealing with identity politics on Tumblr and kind of, you know, took that as a cudgel for dictating who they liked or didn't like on Celebrity. I mean, on the other hand, like, Dave Chappelle's, you know, sort of, like, Netflix special had come out, and my brother had watched it, and he was telling me how furious he was getting when Chappelle was kind of shit talking the people, calling out Kevin Spacey and Louis C.K. and kind of saying how brittle they were. It's like, well, if your dreams of comedy were destroyed by Louis C.K. jerk off in front of you, then you must never had a dream or whatever.
Yeah, just hang up, man.
Yeah, exactly. Like, that kind of stuff. I wish he was here, as I always do, but, like, he was, my brother was mad, and he said, if I had known somebody like my wife or girlfriend or daughter who he was talking about, and I was in that audience, I would walk up to that stage and fucking cane him.
Cane him, wow. Brother doesn't mess around.
I was crying on the sink laughing. but he was really upset, and you know, I was as upset as he was because it was just a lack. What did he say? Your candy ass fled to Africa when people put money in your face, but you're telling women that you're too brittle.
Yeah.
Yeah, none of it. But I think that's an instance of, if you compare, and I regret how this looks because, you know, like, Dave Chappelle's black and J.K. Rowling's white, but, like, in these, ignoring that, in these instances of celebrities getting a situation wrong and expressing how they feel, or lack of expression, or just these two instances. With Dave Chappelle, because he's decided to put this on a public, you know, public performance, there is rope to climb in the way of, I don't want to deal with that guy anymore, if he's committed himself to this belief. And from what I understand with J.K. Rowling, this seems like a case of, you know, miscommunication or just plain ignorance that can still be rectified. And I there's also something about, like, her making one of the characters, like, she like, one of the characters in the book, it has, like werewolfism, and she said, you know, an idea for that was sort of kind of relating to, like, you know, having HIV or whatever, and then a fan said, well, why you just make the person gay or whatever? And I was like, well, that's not really a good look, is it? But I don't know, but like, there are examples of this where you don't, you know, and we talk about this all the time. But I suppose in this way, being biased towards a type of progressivism can also, you know, close doors, as we always love to kind of discuss. And this, you know, call out culture again has to be kind of beneficial rather than gatekeeping.
Right. And I mean, I'm really glad you mentioned Dave Chappelle, because it does kind of introduce the nuance to that, which, because yeah, I mean, with J.K. Rowling, it's like, is it just about the politics of it, or is it just about making a position more than kind of enjoying art or anything else? Because if it's that, then I don't think that jettisoning that person from your life would be an overall net goal, if she has also done other things for you through the Harry Potter mythos, which I seethe through my teeth with disdain. I don't really care.
Do you really not like Harry Potter?
It's an old story. I'm not going to rehash it here.
Oh, no.
Daniel Radcliffe just hung me from the flagpole when I was a kid. No.
I hope that story is true.
I wish. But I mean, but with Dave Chappelle, like, you know, I mean, back in the day, he was my favorite comedian, by which I mean I only liked two comedians, because I just didn't, I didn't do much exploring. I mean, those older specials are still really great, and like, I still remember me and my college roommates, our favorite thing to just like say randomly was just when he's talking about the guy masturbating on the bus. And he's like, hey man, can you stop? And then everybody gets up and they're like, he's right. Put your goddamn cock away. Like, that's classic stuff. Yeah. But I mean, when he put out that special, I think 2 years ago, and it was like really transphobic, and I was just like, fuck this guy. And that was kind of it. But I mean, I wasn't, like, to me, he wasn't somebody like a Kenji Kamiyama or like a Mamoru Oshii or any other Japanese person. See, this is just about Asians and black people now.
The last episode of this podcast will be you and I killing each other.
Exactly. That would kind of make sense, though.
More sense than I thought.
I guess, not
to interrupt real quick, but like, like, Dave Chappelle has a kind of clout about him where it's like, you know, when he talks, we listen, because he had a very piercing and really real things to say about race. Not something that's not necessarily been said before, but like, he really dove into like sort of like racism in his work, and that stuff was appreciated because he really meant it. So when you relate that perspective towards other things and things which he's wrong about or is more ignorant and out of the times with. I was talking about someone, I was arguing on Twitter, or not Twitter, but like Facebook, about somebody who was like, he's right. And I'm like, no, he's not. Like, he's not considering their perspectives. And they basically said, but you don't understand. He says this, and basically repeating what he said. And I was like, I think when he says that, he means it. That doesn't mean he's right. Like, yeah. You know, like, it is that kind of, you know, Stanism, to turn a creative phrase, where it's like, you know, you're being biased towards somebody that you like, rather than just trying to understand the, like, the greater context of the situation. You know, like, I feel that, like, I don't know, I'm not really watching these specials myself, but like, you know, people can be right on some stuff and wrong on other stuff, wrong on other things.
Right, and so where's that line, basically? And so this is kind of the argument that eats itself, because you know, sometimes somebody will say one thing, and we can sit back here and say, oh, it's just one thing, but maybe that one thing is, like, you know, the dagger through your heart. Yeah. And so, I mean, especially, I mean, with Dave Chappelle, I mean, it was, like, trans comments, really, like, oh, man, I miss Bruce Jenner. Like, you're really saying that? And I understood that those specials were filmed, like, a year in advance, but it's just, like, at that point, it's like, fuck off, dude. Like, that's enough. That's so retrograde, and that's that cuts at the core of, like, my politics in this era. And so it's just like, if that's the hill you're going to die on, and not to say that comedy is a political platform, I don't know. It's just like, but then again, if it's something like, I don't know, if it's really hard to say, because if, and I hate to, like, accidentally drag people through the mud, but like, if my idol Rachel Bloom had made some transphobic comment, like, how would I react? And I would probably still accept her because of everything else she does. And that's, I guess it's just like revealing my shittiness. But I also am putting my eggs in a basket of Rachel Bloom, who I trust to not be transphobic or shitty in any way.
Yeah. You really trust her to, like, if she made some sort of faux pas, she would, like, rectify it. Because like, she had a trans character not a character, but, like, you know, someone in the show. Like, it was fleeting, but, like, it was, like, a real trans person, right?
Yeah.
So, like, you know, like that instance isn't likely. Similarly, when the Steven Universe art book came out, there was a potential character design of a Jim, which was deemed to be a racist caricature, and it really was did look like a racist caricature. It wasn't intended to be that way, but like it just ended up looking that way. And Rebecca Sugar came out saying, like, you know, I didn't see that in the you know, sort of like, you know, the behind the scenes process, but I was, you know, this is my show and I'm in charge of overseeing everything that comes out, so I take responsibility and I'm really, really sorry for the hurt it caused. It's like, you know, like that wasn't she didn't draw that thing or whatever, but she took responsibility and maintained in this conversation of a faux pas that this show has done, you know, even in terms of, you know, a character that wasn't really created. We don't want anybody to mistake that we don't take things like race seriously. That in that instance, she didn't want to leave any stone unturned. So that was a mistake that, in my opinion, was sort of, you know, salvaged by not absolution, but what's the word, like, basically just recognizing what that was and kind of, you know, acknowledging what that was and kind of within the hopes and trust to move on. Like with the Killing Joke animated film, kind of people took that as to say, you know, Bruce Timm writes a lot of really sexist shit, where he didn't actually write that movie. That was Brian Azzarello, who's kind of a douchebag. But Tim wasn't. I mean, we interviewed him at Comic-Con, and he was an executive producer over it. And like, it was an instance where Brian Azzarello wrote the script, brought it to Bruce Timm and Alan Burnett, and they approved of it. You know, and they kind of still stood by that really misogynist script. But you know, I mean, even Tara Strong maintains that she really loved that script herself. So it's like, you know, they're missing out on the greater argument of misogyny. But I don't really write them off for that instance. You know, they've also been a part of very feminist work. So it's like, you know, people can have blind spots, and even if they don't agree with that instance, doesn't mean that, like, therefore they hate, you know, they there for everything misogynist, because I don't know, people are complex in that kind of way. I mean, they can be wrong, but like, in this way, am I being biased towards them and not writing them off forever? I don't know. Maybe.
Well, yeah,
I know.
But I think that's an all right bias. I think that's kind of what we're kind of reaching towards. And it's actually funny, I mentioned a couple of Japanese anime directors, because when you think about somebody like Hideo Kojima, like, you praise him for his avant-garde genius or whatever video game critics say. But, you know, he has characters like Quiet, and he has the guy who, like, shits himself, and it's just like, he's a weird guy who doesn't always get it straight, but we kind of take him lumps and all, and he's pretty awesome.
I saw that freaking late at night. I saw that thing for, like, Death Stranding. With, yeah, like, Norman Reedus and the baby.
Oh, man.
And it was like, too deep for you, genius!
Yeah. Oh, man. But, I mean, even for me, like, with Kenji Kamiyama, like, I've forgotten, like, all the creepy stuff that goes on in Standalone Complex, because it's just such a kind of familiar-feeling show, but there's a lot of weirdness in there. But I don't write him off, because what he's done for me is what J.K. Rowling has done for so many Harry Potter readers, which is just gonna let that sit. I'm not even gonna do that, because you know, I mean, Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex and also Morabito mean the world to me, and so it would take a lot for him to kind of go away in my eyes. But I think we should try to move on at this point.
Well, oh crap, I had a point. It's like, I don't know, like, I think in this, it's similar to bring up, you know, something against Kenji Kamiyama. Like I don't like them because this thing I felt was really kind of offensive or whatever. Would you, like, straight up deny it and try to, you wouldn't try to gaslight them. You would probably acknowledge that's true, but not let them go yourself, right?
Right. I mean, I think the way that Claire Napier did it on her, on The Major's Body was probably the best way to go, which is just acknowledge people's feelings, acknowledge her own feelings. Obviously, she was grossed out, but specifically, this is the instance of the major being a pedophile, which is like,
oh,
God,
yeah,
damn it, just shoot me in the face right now. I don't want to live in this world anymore.
She really, always what now?
I take my anime very seriously. But, you know, what she does is, especially since this is a work from Japan and she's in England, so she doesn't want to be ethnocentric, so she's going to examine it from all angles. And she's an amazing media critic. Unfortunately, she writes mostly about comic books, which I just have no idea about. Still, through all my years of friendship with you, I still this just so much.
Well, I'm very vague about what I like and don't like, so I can't imagine how you can get into it.
Well, yeah, it's a big world out there, and she talks about like some weird stuff too. But she's an incredible critic, and one of the things she does is just kind of give everybody their fair shake. But still, she will come to a conclusion in the end. And you know, that scene is like, no matter how you can kind of explain it, but it's always going to be weird, and that's okay. Like, that's a directorial misstep or something worse, and that's fine. Like, at some point, you do have to separate the artist from the off. The artist from the art, and that's okay.
We referenced this earlier, like way back in the podcast. But I think for just a refresher, just so people won't get lost and turn off the show, like in Ghost in the Shell Standalone Complex, there's a scene where the major is like with this like 11-year-old boy or whatever, and I forget exactly what the episode's about, but like basically they have to, you know, like share a hotel room or whatever, and they go to sleep, and they share the same bed, and like she's like in a thong or something, and she's pretty topless. Yeah. And the boy, who's, you know, on the cusp of puberty or something, like asks her if she can have sex, or she's able to have sex because she's a full body cyborg, and she kind of like, you know, presents herself nude to him, saying like do you want to find out? And he's like, oh no. And that's, you know, that's a very kind of shocking scene, because it's a pretty like clinical and not anime-esque anime show, if I can say that way. But like, it is kind of shocking, because like it's you know, her inviting the crime of pedophilia, and you kind of start questioning the men behind writing that female character, all this kind of stuff. That's what we're referencing when it's like that scene, you know. And Claire Napier, writer for Women Who Write Comics, you know, had this great. I read it was a great essay series, a series of articles on the major character in Ghost in the Shell, and that scene in particular. So
yeah, I mean, and they give you. Oh, sorry, I think.
No, back to you.
I mean, in that scene, they give you just enough to kind of be like, well, maybe it could be like she knows that she's not going to have sex with this kid. She's just trying to test him and all this crap. I mean, it's the exact same with the 95 movie. All those losers out there saying, well, she has to be naked. I don't even know anymore, man. I don't even know what were we talking about?
It's like, you know, like Kenji Kamiyama was behind the show. He was a showrunner behind that show. So I guess were somebody to bring that up, I guess I said if somebody were to bring up something that he did, and he's like Claire Napier brought that up, and you acknowledge that that's weird, without saying for this reason I now hate him,
right? But at the same time, he's not like, I mean, he is kind of my number one guy, but I'm still not gonna like invest my identity in this guy, and not just because of this. Like, I can excuse that. Like, it's not the worst thing ever. It's not like evidence of bigotry or something like that. It's just this weird thing that wasn't done very well that will read differently in America, or in England, as it were. But again, like, I guess it's kind of like this is more about throwing somebody away or but I mean, we started this podcast talking about how you're supposed to break from party lines when you have to.
I know. I was thinking about that. It's still bias related. But these are instances of us revealing each other to be hypocrites.
I know.
but seriously though, there is not to like, you know, say, but guys, there's a difference between, you know, people in the media and not so much media, but like, you know, in like pop culture and, you know, science fiction, all the kind of stuff, and geek culture, and, you know, the White House. But it is all related to bias. And I think that, like, although we're talking about our favorites in kind of problematic scenarios, I think these people that we're talking about who have been in these problematic scenarios have demonstrated themselves to be at least salvageable, comparable to Donald Trump.
Well, most people are.
Yeah, for real. To really wrap it all around, you know, contrition, I think, is the word I was looking for. Where it's an old Catholic term, I believe, where, you know, just the act of contrition and the act of wanting to make amends or recognizing someone. Someone's, you know, recognizing the reality for somebody, or at least the perspective of somebody else, and not trying to do that person harm. You know, Trump doesn't give a fuck about the millions of people who would be murdered by him if he were to, like, you know, kind of blow it up just to prove to Kim Jong-un that he could. And say, oh, you know, they were going for the nuclear weapons, I told you about it, or whatever. Like, or even the millions of Americans that could be killed in a nuclear war. It's all about posturing, because you think that's the way that things get done. And, you know, a lot of men think that that's the way things get done. A lot of women think that that's the way things get done. But that's just, you know, like, that's an outdated sense of masculinity and personhood, quite frankly. Compared to all these other scenarios, these people that we're talking about, Rebecca Sugar, Kenji Kamiyama, and Rachel Bloom, Bruce Timm, to a lesser extent, they've demonstrated a more fully dimensional perspective, which isn't monolithic in how it might make itself make mistakes or do one thing or the other. So we're more inclined to give them the benefit of the doubt, or at least recognize when they do a faux pas that the likelihood of them doing that again to a worse degree is unlikely. And I don't know, you know what? A scenario that that just came to me that I thought about, that I'll kind of explain to you about, is, and I've talked about this before, but is the writer Chuck Dixon.
Mm-hmm.
He's a comic writer who basically defined, I mean, Daniel Neal kind of did it, but he really kind of defined the Batman era comic books in the 1990s, because he didn't create the third Robin Tim Drake, but he wrote like 100 issues of a series. He actually kind of wrote the entire series up to 100 issues. You know, he started the Nightwing series, he wrote Birds of Prey, and, you know, the Oracle character, you know, he kind of, like, came with a lot of characters. Like, he's really kind of seen as a rock for that. And he is known today as a very conservative writer. I mean, he's actually done writing commissions for, like, people who associate themselves with the alt-right group, which is kind of really depressing. But in talking about the guy, and I think it's a Trump voter, but in talking, you know, and I've interviewed the guy via email, and I've even read some of his old stuff, and he does come off as a very intelligent, not insane person. Like, he's never said anything remote. I mean, I'm looking at his old work now. He's never done anything or said anything remotely sexist or racist or anything. And I even remember when I was interviewing him saying that, you know, you've written a number of terrific female characters throughout your career. How did that come to you in a way which didn't come off as, you know, just kind of being a token female writer or whatever? And he was kind of saying, yeah, well, you know, I grew up with sisters, and I don't like the idea that, you know, women are lesser than men or whatever, which you know, you wouldn't expect from a guy who, you know, thinks the alt-right is no big deal. But there was another scenario where, like, he objected to, and he thinks he lost his job over, he objected to a storyline in Green Arrow where one of the sidekicks was revealed to have HIV because she was like a former prostitute or whatever. He thought that was sort of writing politics into comic books. And I said, but you've written stories about, you know, teenage pregnancy and, you know, teenage sex and gun violence or whatever. What exactly is the difference? And I don't exactly remember what he said. But he's a guy who I very much like and respect. And even though he's recently, you know, his work has aligned itself with the alt-right movement and basically everything that I stand against, I've not felt the need or urgency to kind of, you know, write him off as, oh, well, he's just a douchebag or whatever. And I don't know if I need to hear from his lips things that Richard Spencer would have said. Maybe that would be the tell. But, like, that's a scenario where I've yet to cut him off from my, I guess, Christmas card list or whatever.
Yeah. No, I mean, that is kind of the point, is that between all the people we've mentioned, and the difference between them, including Dixon and Donald Trump, is that in terms of his voters, is that there are things that the people we love can do for us to dismiss them. They just haven't done it yet. I mean, the Rota thing with Kenji Kamiyama was bad. I guess Rachel Bloom hasn't done anything yet, and maybe she never will, but she could. I mean, people are people, and they're whatever liable or as much as anybody. So if they were outed as a pedophile and tried to run for Senate, I wouldn't vote for them. So there is a line for me. And so I think ultimately, like, I guess we have to kind of excise Donald Trump from the equation because he's so awful. Like, he has no ideology. He's just a con artist who is ailing. So I guess that's almost a point in his favor. But he just represents the worst of humanity. And so you have to kind of, like, look at the people around you in your life, look at the people who you like, and just kind of reset everything and then say, what is it you like about them or dislike about them? And then apply that principle to everybody you come across before you hit the rare button again on them in terms of call out and make them go away. Like, you have to do that work for everybody. because I think everybody would deserve that, no matter what transgression they have done or whatever.
But you say we should excise Donald Trump from the conversation. I don't know if I can do that because I feel that like that sort of kind of spurred on a lot of my anxiety. I don't have anxiety, but like, you know, it cuts out of my insanity. I kind of what the crux of this was at one point was basically evil bias. You know, is there such a thing as, you know, good bias and bad bias? And I guess if bias is something toward is if bias lends itself to the idea that people can be redeemed, then it invites an acknowledgement into, you know, doing wrong to other people. But like the bias that I was talking about at the top of the show with my friend on Facebook was basically an appeal to willing ignorance, essentially, and partisanship, which is harmful, which is bias that I think, you know, you and I have, you know, rejected. And in these scenarios with these people, what they've done has yet to prove itself harmful. I mean, you know, people. I don't know. I don't want to get too far with that because people say, well, this person has written this one thing and that has triggered me, and I find that harmful to myself. That's a very case by case basis.
Yeah.
And quite frankly, while all of those things, all those scenarios should be taken seriously and kind of be seen as a projection as to what we would allow, you know, in terms of, like, you know, accepting creative works or whatever, not every one of those scenarios is going to be a way to, you know, our venue into our road into looking for, our path into looking forward. That's not every scenario is going to be one to look up to, essentially, because people might just get upset for the wrong reasons. But again, as you say, Trump is the worst of humanity, and literally dicking around with nuclear war is definitely a reason to get upset, obviously. But I suppose, because I know we've proven ourselves to be somewhat hypocritical on this, but it is one of those things, because, like, you know, we never said we were not biased, but
that's how we get you.
That was a trick. How would you? Is there a way in which? Well, that's impossible, because we're not conceding that any of our sort of, you know, really strong held beliefs are wrong. But I suppose, I don't know. I think it would kind of go back to the scenario where, like, for instance, if were we to be registered Republicans, and then Trump came out with that tweet. Like, I should say that, like, somebody I didn't necessarily know had said, you know, she's a Trump voter and a Republican, but that tweet really freaked her out, and she didn't like it. You know, so that's a scenario of somebody who at least is not so biased that they call that how they see it in that instance. They recognize that for what it is. I don't know. I'm not necessarily asking that. Like, you and I promise to be non-biased from here on out. that's easier said than done. But recognizing it within ourselves, I guess it can also lead to, you know, kind of a lack of confidence in ourselves, and sort of a lack of conviction or whatever. It's like, oh, I'm just saying that because I like this way or whatever. I don't know. I gave you a list of, like, you know, confirmation biases and all that kind of stuff. I didn't necessarily, like, you know, use it to kind of, you know, travel back in my own past, but
I did.
that's awesome. What did that list anyway? Kind of bring that out.
Let's see. Illusion of truth effect. Identifying statements as true. Well, actually, to kind of go into this, and this is kind of its own episode, really. But, you know, I think a big thrust of what we're talking about is that we want the opposition to hold themselves to a standard of self-reflection that we don't think that they're doing, and so we have to kind of embody that self-reflection first, in without showcasing or whatever, just kind of really actually do that work to then get a better grasp of what they're supposed to be doing and not doing. And I think that a chart like this, which we'll, I guess, show on the website, is a good starting point to really look through all these different cognitive biases, which is to say illusion truth effect, shared information bias, courtesy bias, the Ben Franklin effect, which is really fascinating, things like that, and just kind of think about examples of your life where that's been a factor, and then kind of, I don't know, like, just reflect on those, I guess, and that's all we're asking from these people, because I think that to kind of recognize that there is this kind of absurd, anti-human or frankly, you know, Eichmann-esque adherence to the party line, I think understanding your biases is enough to break that. So I guess I would be more interested in the process of breaking through biases, but that would have to be for the sequel podcast.
Yeah, sure. That would kind of be your sort of Clockwork Orange, sort of, you know, kind of like mind manipulation kind of thing going on, where it's, yeah, like, you know, like you must understand this now kind of thing. We're kind of expressing that this sort of mindless bias is out there, and is super harmful. And I don't know. An interesting thing. This is you know, another tangent, but it is related. I was on my friend's. She's written this show before. I was on my friend Stella's anniversary episode for her podcast, Backward to Oracle, and we were reading this 5-part crossover between like the Bat books and like the Green Arrow books. And there's this character that came up from the Green Arrow books, who was basically Chuck Norris. I mean, he actually kind of looked like Chuck Norris. And everybody said, "Oh, he's the most awesomest guy ever. He's like the greatest marksman ever. You know, he went toe to toe with Deathstroke and came out alive and all this kind of stuff." And I was like thinking, like, you know, who the fuck is this? Why, I never heard of him. Like this ridiculous character they're trying to shove down our throats. What bad writing. Mm-hmm. And then, like, we were, you know, like, Lady Shiva was in this crossover. It's like, well, people who don't read Batman comics might think of her as, you know, who is she? Why is she the greatest martial artist ever? How can she kick everybody's ass? It's like we never heard of her. And it's like, that's sort of bias that I think on the podcast we recognize as, you know, okay, well, we like this one character that we know, but we don't like this character that we don't know because we're being told that we ought to like him.
Yep.
Which I feel is some sort of named bias or whatever. But I think that's an instance, I think, to make myself look good, of kind of just recognizing that kind of bias within myself. I think you might kind of backtracking, you might be right in kind of leaving Trump out of this, because that is sort of an extreme instance. Of course, you know, as we've demonstrated, you know, or at least I've demonstrated that the people who vote for him were and still are my friends for now. And I want to either save them or prevent more of them from spawning, I guess.
Right.
And I'm not sure how to do that. I guess it's just a almost 2-hour expression of acknowledging there is a problem before figuring out how to solve it.
Yeah, but I mean that is the first step, and I appreciate that step.
Yes. I'm not really sure if I have anything else. Like is there anything else you kind of want to mention?
Well, not really. I mean, the bias that you were describing with BTO is on this chart, mere exposure effect, which is expressing undue appreciation for something just because it's familiar, which does relate to in-group favoritism, the cross-race effect, all that stuff. Bias. I mean, cognitive biases are really fascinating, and it might sound like it doesn't really relate to politics, but if you could kind of you know, mesh the two disciplines, I think you could really get something useful that might be like almost like a spiritual awakening for an atheist.
I will probably put these images on the website so people can kind of check them out. I'm not going to do it, but I'd almost wish that people who do write in kind of say how they listen to the podcast or find it. But and that might be a good idea for us to kind of further pimp it out.
But yeah. Gross.
Lack of a better phrase.
Okay, so it's 2018. I guess we're retiring that word now. That's my mission.
I can think of no better place for this center of diplomacy than here in orbit around the neutral planet. What are your thoughts on this momentous occasion, your neutralness?
I have no strong feelings one way or the other.
Planet Express ship. I come swinging the olive branch of peace.
Should we trust him, your neutralness?
All I know is my gut says maybe.
I hate these filthy neutrals, Kif. With enemies, you know where they stand, but with neutrals, who knows? It sickens me. What makes a man turn neutral? Lust for gold? Power? Or were you just born with a heart full of neutrality?
Next episode, we're going to do the romantic tropes episode. Which ones are good, which ones we think are bad, and how can they evolve in this era of kind of thinking on how things can evolve? What do romantic tropes look like in tomorrow's utopia? Maybe.
Whoa.
I know that's a bit of a lofty goal, but you know, who says we've never tried, you know, shoot for the stars and fall on the ground. But if you have thoughts on romantic tropes, more contributing thoughts on romantic tropes, or on our episode on bias that we did tonight, again, join the Facebook page, comment on this episode, comment just on the post on the page, write in on our email, qnomoanswers@gmail.com, comment on the website, leave us comments on the website, which I think I really not had too many at all.
Ever.
And ever. And yeah, we want the feedback train going so we can kind of hear from other people, because we can only do so much with our, you know, sort of like peeking brains, the brain size of mice. Anything else before we close up for tonight, Harry?
See the Shape of Water now playing. I don't know.
Oh wow! It seems that Guillermo del Toro is giving you a laundry bag with a dollar sign on it.
Exactly. Everybody gets in the podcasting game to make money, so I've heard.
I freaking wish, man. I remember back in the day, I heard that, like, oh, they're going to start charging all podcasts, like, 45 cents to listen to on iTunes. And I was like, are they? And it never happened.
So. You would never, ever listen to a podcast if it cost 45 cents. Ever.
I wouldn't listen to the Nerdist podcast, because I was like, oh, that's not worth it. But I would definitely listen to my own.
All the money's going right back into my pocket. That's the American dream.
Yes. Capitalism, we loves it.
Oh, man.
Good night, everybody. No mistakes on this Jake one. He makes beats well like I likes my steaks done. With sauteed onions and hella Worcestershire. A gush of beer to wash it down, douche your ear, and clean the crud out your third eye. For the return of the word guy who known to make turds fly at the first fan base of all hater. Hold that for now, it's more waste for y'all later. The bigger the gall, they fall greater than gay skirt. The nigga they call for tall paper, hit pay dirt. Say work, you do your one better show and prove it. True MCs flow, so lose it or move it. With the 2 bits, spit they something for 2 cents. Whoever writ they shit, tell them quit it, they too bent. Cut the losses, it ain't balanced what the cost is in horses. Oxygen can let them know who's the boss is. Yo, son. Yo, son. Only the innate way the groove seemed to paint your mental. Using the insane flow stencil. He said in plain English ain't paying your rent bill. But still, the gent was ill. With the intent to kill, the scent was krill. To the full extent of skill, vent the grill. Villa make him feel like the deal. Spent a mill, meant it for real, folks. Bet your dying dollar. Dented the steel choke when he met the iron collar. Broke this oath while pinching a loaf. Metal face rhyme, say his mention them both.